Welcome to Food Matters Live. This is the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, I want to explore one of the areas where medicine and the food industry interact by looking at the relationship between diet and healthy aging. Now, life expectancy has fallen in the UK very recently, largely down to the coronavirus pandemic, but it had been rising consistently since the end of the Second World War. But us pesky aging folk can create a number of problems. The UK government's Foresight report into the future of an aging population points out that without significant improvements, ill health, chronic conditions, and cognitive impairments will become more common. The question for us is, can our diet help to prevent these things? And what can we learn from the food culture in places where people live the longest, healthiest lives? We've all heard about the benefits of the Mediterranean diet, but if we really pull it apart, what in practical terms can we do with it? Well, with me to discuss this is the fantastic Rosie Martin. Now, Rosie is a registered dietitian working with the Exeter NHS Trust and founder of Rosemary Nutrition and Dietetics. Rosie, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me on.
Ah, it's a great pleasure. Now, the link between diet, health and ageing is really important. And you know, you've clearly got a front row seat with your work in the NHS. Can you outline for us the main problems around ageing and diet that you encounter in your job?
Absolutely. So you're absolutely right. Working in the NHS, you really see sort of the front line of disease and ill health. And you know, aging affects all of us. Whatever age we are, we're all getting older. And this is mostly sort of a natural process of functional decline, vulnerability to disease and death due to the gradual accumulation of molecular and cellular damage, which sounds morbid, but I will come on to some more positive news soon.
Morbid, but inevitable. Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, absolutely. We'll lay it out as it is. So as a dietitian, I generally come across two different problems related to aging. So the first one is the changing nutritional requirements and nutritional issues in older adults or in the elderly. So simply being older puts us at more risk of diseases like cancer, heart disease, and diverticular disease. And at the same time, our requirements change, our appetite can change, we become more frail, and we often lose the ability to take care of ourselves.
So diverticular disease is intestinal disease, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So intestinal diseases, absolutely. That's just kind of an example of one of the diseases that we see increasing in older age. Yeah. Second one here is problems related to more sort of diet and lifestyle long term in our younger years that then contribute to the aging process and lead us to live with more years in poor health, or what we call DALYs, or disability adjusted life years. So years lost to disability and poor health. And these two things are connected. So in some cases, age-related physiological changes can impact on nutritional intake and status. And in others, nutritional intake and status can impact on how we age as well. And I think what some people perhaps don't realise is that ageing appears to be only loosely associated with our chronological age. So that's the good news. that's the positive news that we wanted to come on to. Ageing is a lifelong process that's influenced by, you know, as we'll talk about, lifestyle, so diet, but also things like smoking, physical activity, alcohol, stress, but also many other factors, economic factors, income, employment, health and social care systems, physical environment, our living conditions, our social environment, and also sort of cultural and personal factors as well. So it's pretty multifactorial.
So in that second sort of area, the diet, your diet in your younger years, are we essentially sort of stockpiling a series of potential problems that will cause us difficulty later on in life?
Absolutely. Aging is that ongoing process throughout our lives. So how we live as younger adults or even in adolescence impacts how we're going to age later on in life. It lays down the foundations of our health and risk of chronic disease. So, you know, we're talking about nutrition and aging, but actually it's not just the older population who, you know, might want to listen to the information. It's everyone really, because, you know, we're all aging, whatever age we are.
Yeah. And so this is, I mean, this is fascinating. So the concept of aging, it's not just getting old. You're sort of saying that it's molecular and cellular damage. Aging is a negative health issue, which is separate from just getting old, which we all just do anyway. It's about the damage that we might create.
Absolutely. There's actually been sort of 9 cellular and molecular hallmarks of aging that have been identified. And this is all part of a normal aging process, but can be affected by all the things that we've talked about. So this includes things like genomic instability, so genetic damage that's not repaired, telomere shortening, or the loss of those protective caps at the end of chromosomes at each replication, things like cellular senescence, so the dysfunction of cells that then promotes chronic inflammation and impacts other nearby healthy cells to become senescent too. So there are lots of different processes, but we know that all of these molecular processes and these molecular and cellular damage that's occurring are impacted by not just how old we're getting, but also how we're living our lives and what we're choosing to do with our lives as well.
Yeah. So just before we dive into the detail of this, can we cure isn't the right word, is it? Can we resolve a lot of the aging issues, or is that just fanciful? You know, can we really make effective change by changing our diet? Are you living your life, dietary and the stress and the way that you live your life, in order to solve these problems that are, you know, going to be coming down the line at you later on in life?
Absolutely. So when we think about aging, actually, a lot of us will assume that that's genetic. You know, what happens is, you know, foretold in the stars.
It's inevitable. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. But actually, when we look at it, there have been studies to show that actually only 20 to 30% of our aging is genetic related, which means that there's a huge potential there for differences in aging. And obviously, you know, as a population, we have kind of a limited health span. We can't live forever. There is investigations into aging finding that, you know, certain manipulations of certain enzymes and things can help with aging, but then they then have other side effects and consequences elsewhere and certain pathways. So there's a potential for the future in terms of what we can discover. But I think when we take it back to practical things that we can do, we know a lot already about how we can think about sort of lifespan, but also health span. Yeah. So, you know, when we're talking about longer lives, we are all living longer lives. And that's quite an incredible thing that's happened in our modern society, and an incredible achievement that we've had is that we're living much longer lives, but we're not necessarily living healthy through those lives. So yeah, there's a difference really between lifespan and health span. Two different kind of things there that we want to think about.
It's a great way to say it as well. I get that completely.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in today's society, we can live to our 80s, 90s, maybe even 100s. So with some of the patients that I've seen and when I've worked on sort of care of the elderly wards. But many of those years, as we said, are spent in ill health. So things like pain, heart conditions, cancer, dementia, all those sorts of things that affect us when we get older. In fact, more than half of people aged 65 and over have at least 2 chronic health conditions. And this is also leads to things like polypharmacy, multiple medications that someone might be on, which have side effects of their own. So for example, things like poor digestion or a dry mouth that might impact on food intake and kind of sets you off on a bit of a cycle there. So, you know, as I said, the great news in all of this is that although many of us view these conditions as a normal part of aging, many of them can be prevented or delayed by our lifestyle behaviours, so what we choose to do day to day throughout our lives. And as I said, you know, our genes may only account for 20 to 30% of ageing, with the majority of the variation in overall lifespan and health span being environmental. So, you know, not just how we live our lives, but our access to healthcare, immunisation and other more social determinants of health as well.
So up to 70% of our health in later life, we can sort of influence ourselves. That's actually incredibly exciting. You know, I'm very happy to die. That's not a problem. Dying, the inevitability of that is I'm good with that. But in my later years, I'd like to be healthy and therefore potentially happier. And that's the crucial thing. So if I can influence 70% of that, that's amazing. I never realised that. Mm-hmm. Okay, can you define, you've said it a little bit, but can you define exactly what healthy aging should be?
Yeah, so the World Health Organization defines healthy aging as the process of developing and maintaining the functional ability that enables well-being in older age. So that's kind of what we would define as healthy aging. And we've talked about the kind of health span and lifespan. So I think healthy aging refers to more about that health span and how long we're living in a healthy life, you know, able to be mobile and look after ourselves and engage in daily activities.
So if we can influence 70% of that health span, how big a factor is diet within that? Is there much evidence about the impact of what we eat on our health span?
Absolutely. So when we think about those different pathways that we mentioned before, so those sort of nine factors of aging, along with something called, I don't know if you've heard of inflammaging.
No, that's a new one on me. I like it. Okay, what does it mean?
Yes, yeah, so basically the impact of inflammation and aging. So the process whereby our immune system gets a little bit out of balance, more pro-inflammatory effects, leading to sort of a low-grade chronic inflammation, which makes us more susceptible to disease. So, for example, the elderly lose lymphoid tissue, which is important in our immune response, and have a decreased response to vaccinations, which is why older populations are more at risk of infections, such as COVID-19, as we've seen very recently. And our skin barriers are weaker as well. Our mucous membranes, those first line of defense to external pathogens. But as you said, this process is all impacted by what we choose to eat. So although diet is just one factor in aging, it plays a big role. So one study that I found out of the US looked at 17 major risk factors in aging and found that the composition of diet constituted the largest cluster of risk factors responsible for death, so 26%, and the highest percentage of disability adjusted years at 14%. So this really gives us an indication of how important what we feed our body really is on our both our lifespan and health span.
And that's exciting as well, because it is something that we have control over and we can change if we need to.
Absolutely.
Well, theoretically, we can change it.
Yes, yeah.
More difficult to actually implement that change.
Yeah, on a practical level, obviously, as a dietitian, that's what I work with people to do. And you're right, it's not always an easy thing to do. But I think it's a powerful sort of thing to understand. It's something that gives us that little bit of control and that little bit of power. And the World Health Organization estimate that around 80% of coronary heart disease and type 2 diabetes, as well as 40% of cancers, which is a huge percentage and some of our biggest killers in the UK, could be prevented by lifestyle changes. So they stated those as eating habits, physical activity, and tobacco use. And they mentioned that of these risk factors, diet is thought to be the most important modifiable risk factor. You know, if we think in addition to this, dietary interventions have shown that shifting to a healthier diet pattern beneficially impacts our particular lipids, inflammation-related risk factors. So things like LDL cholesterol, so the unhealthy cholesterol that we have in our blood, as well as things like CRP, which is C-reactive protein, which is a measure of inflammation in our body. And the effects of food actually rival pharmacotherapy, so drug therapy in many interventions as well, which shows, you know, the influence of what we eat and how that can affect our body. And we're eating, you know, at least three times every day, most of us, every day, every year throughout our lives. So it can really add up to make some big impacts on our health. So, it really does stand to reason that, a population-wide shift to a better diet pattern could lead to significant delays in age-related diseases, leading to those substantial improvements in lifespan and health span. I don't know if you've heard of a study in Finland, in North Karelia, I think. Sorry to any Finnish if I said that wrong. But this was a comprehensive lifestyle intervention that included dietary advice as part of it. It lasted over three decades and it was associated with an 80% risk reduction for cardiovascular disease, which is huge. So that was, alongside lower levels of smoking, they had dietary advice, which helped to lower their cholesterol and also their blood pressure as well. So again, that really shows the impact that we can have with diet and health and longevity.
I've certainly been in conferences where there have been huge arguments with people about whether or not food is medicine at some level, because without it, you would die. And it provides you with a whole set of things that apply to your health. What's your view on that? Is it helpful to see food as a subsection of medicine?
You're absolutely right. This is quite divided out there. So, whichever way I go, I'll get some kind of resistance. But I do believe that diet, we can view it as a form of medicine. Absolutely. When it has such powerful effects on the way that our body works, it really, can be seen as something that we can use to our advantage to help health conditions and to prevent health conditions. So I believe that it is a form of medicine, but I think some people might fight against that and say, if you're saying that, then you're putting you know, what we don't want to do is put blame onto people to say, you know, you're the reason why you got this condition, it's your fault.
Yes.
Because we're talking about risk reduction, we're not talking about either getting it or not getting it. So I think it's important not to associate that food as medicine with any kind of blame culture around people becoming unwell.
Yeah. The one area you've talked a little bit less about so far is bone health. Mm. And I wonder if you could expand a little bit on that, you know, loss of bone density as we age and osteoporosis, those sorts of issues.
Yeah, so these are some of the things that are associated with as we get older, things that we need to think about. So our body composition changes and so do our nutritional requirements. So one of the main things that we want to think about is bone health. So when it comes to bone health, we know that our bones reduce in density from around the age of 30. So at that quite tender age, we do need to be thinking about bone health that affects us a lot in later life. And this is particularly pronounced in women who have been through the menopause due to the reduction in estrogen. And this can lead to osteoporosis, which is a debilitating condition that can increase our risk of things like back or hip fracture, which can lead to disability, reduced quality of life, and ultimately death as well. When we're thinking about bone health, we want to think about specific nutrients as well as how we're living. So two of the main things that are well known are vitamin D and calcium in bone health. So these are important factors influencing our bones. Calcium is an essential building block of bones and teeth. And vitamin D actually helps us to absorb the calcium that we need. So there's no point in having a diet that's super high in calcium, but then being deficient in vitamin D because we just then don't have access to that calcium. So these two really go hand in hand. We get vitamin D predominantly from the sun. So it's made in our skin. It's actually a hormone that we make on sun exposure. And there's evidence to suggest that the older adult population can't synthesize this vitamin D as efficiently because of a lack of the precursor. So many older adults are also less mobile, so may not have sufficient sun exposure in addition. So this means that vitamin D supplementation is really beneficial for bone health and fall risk as well in those over 50 years. So I would recommend a 10 microgram supplement of vitamin D daily, and also plenty of calcium rich foods as well in the diet.
Yeah.
But we also know it's not just calcium and vitamin D. We also need to think about other factors of bone health as well, things like vitamin K and magnesium. So it comes back to ensuring a really healthy and varied dietary pattern to get all of those things we need. And in fact, we may not associate fruits and vegetables with bone health, but actually one systematic review and meta-analysis published in 2019 found that there was an association between an increase in at least one serving of fruits and vegetables per day and decreasing the risk of bone fractures as well. So although we might not think of fruit and veg as being sort of bone healthy, we might think about it more in sort of metabolic disease or weight loss. Mm. Actually, it has huge benefits for bone health as well.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into this conversation to ask a quick favour. I've been hosting this podcast with Food Matters Live for more than 3 years now, and we love that our community has stuck with us and grown in that time. But instead of me doing all the talking, we want to hear from you. We'd love to hear your comments, your suggestions, criticisms, and questions. Are there any topics you think we should be covering? Any guests that you really want to hear from? Let us know by email at info@foodmatterslive.com or contact us on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. And if you like what you're hearing, it would be enormously helpful if you could leave us a review of the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred platform. Thank you so much for listening, and now back to the chat. There have been lots of discussions and lots of articles in newspapers about different diets and age correlation, you know, health and aging correlations between those. So let's have a quick look at some of these places. There's a project called Blue Zones, which attempts to analyse the areas where the world's healthiest people live, initiated by National Geographic. Can you tell us a little bit about this project? What's revealed in terms of aging and health? And are there actual kind of practical takeaways that we can gain from that knowledge?
Absolutely. So the Blue Zones is a really interesting project that has gained a lot of attention. So there are five areas in the world that are geographically isolated, and these have been termed the Blue Zones. So this includes Icaria, Loma Linda in California, Sardinia in Italy, Okinawa in Japan and Nicoya in Costa Rica. And as you said, these are places where the average population lives longer and healthier than the rest of the world. So these places seem to have an above average number of people living into their 90s and 100s, but being mobile and in good health as well, with low risk of chronic disease, often the chronic diseases that are so common in other populations. So once these blue zones were identified, the researchers naturally wanted to find out why, so we can start to apply anything we can find to other populations and even to ourselves as well. So on studying the diet and lifestyle of these particular populations, the study came up with something called the Power Nine. And these are nine habits that these populations all have in common. So I'll talk about some of the non-nutritional ones first. So the first one is they move naturally. So they don't purposefully exercise for exercise sake. They live in an environment that promotes them to move in their day-to-day life. They have purpose. So they have a reason to get up in the morning throughout their lives. So whether it's a job, family responsibilities, they don't really retire per se.
Yeah.
They have a downshift, so they experience stress, you know, that they're all human, but they have routines that alleviate stress. So whether this is a nap in the afternoon, a time for prayer or a time for reflection. They belong to a community with very faith-based services and gatherings. They seem to put loved ones first as well. So, for example, they keep aging parents and grandparents in with the family unit or close by. They commit to a life partner and they invest in time with their children as well. And they have kind of the right tribes. They have a social circle of committed friends. When it comes to more of the sort of food-based ones, they actually have alcohol in their diet. So they have a kind of wine at five type of routine where they...
So glad you said that.
Where they drink, so they drink regular alcohol, but it's done moderately and it's done with friends and with food. So the kind of environment around it is very promoting of health and social connection. So wine is kind of a side to that rather than wine being, you know, what they would drink on its own and enjoy that individually. There are two sort of main nutrition-based factors that all these places appear to have in common, despite being quite separate. The first one is that they have predominantly whole food, plant-based diets. So they don't have kind of your fast food burger chains or chocolate and crisps on offer at the supermarket tills, just whole fresh foods that are cooked from scratch. In fact, the populations eat pretty much a 95% plant-based diet. And if they do eat meat and dairy and those sorts of things, meat particularly, I think, is only around about five times a month. So it is more of kind of a special occasion or thought of as a treat. And plants aren't just a side order here. They make up kind of the mainstay of the diet, which has hugely beneficial consequences on the body. So plant proteins like beans are a cornerstone of the diet, along with things like vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts. And these foods provide things like fiber, which is really crucial for gut health and a gut healthy, healthy gut microbiome, which we're finding out more about all the time, which is another fascinating area. Plant protein, unsaturated or healthy fats, vitamins, minerals, things like phytochemicals, which we're finding out more about as well. So these are beneficial plant compounds that provide health benefits kind of over and above vitamins and minerals. And they can actually do things like upregulate beneficial enzymes in the body and reduce our risk of cancer and provide sort of anti-inflammatory effects as well. So the dietary pattern is known to be health promoting and reduce our risk of things like cancer, diabetes, obesity and dementia. And we know that the opposite kind of diet to those seen in the blue zones, a high intake of animal products provides, you know, things like increased saturated fat, heme iron, nitrates and nitrites and other substances that, you know, when we cook meat at high temperatures, like polycyclic amines, that can damage cells, so leading to long-term sort of diseases. And we know that the World Cancer Research Fund has categorized that red meat and processed meat as carcinogenic, meaning they cause cancer. So they're really having low intakes of these types of foods. The second factor that we see in common nutritionally across these blue zones is that they eat until they're about 80% full. So they have a kind of an 80% rule. So we do know from scientific research that actually calorie restriction over a long period of time has been associated with increased longevity. As a dietitian, I don't recommend anyone restricts themselves if they're physiologically hungry, but it's about eating until you're satisfied rather than eating until you're really, really full. So in fact, when we're thinking about the previous one that we talked about, so eating a predominantly plant-based diet, this can support a reduction in calories without even noticing, really, because you're having an intake of a higher amount of fiber and water. And so there's less energy per weight of food than other foods. So you can really fill yourself up and feel satisfied, but you've naturally taken in less energy. So it's thought that adopting a Blue Zones lifestyle could add up to 10, 20 years to your life expectancy. But, you know, you have to have the setup around you as well. So I think that's why our society can take some lessons from the Blue Zones for a population level change, which I know is starting to happen in specific areas in the UK. You know, they're starting to look at how the Blue Zones live and setting up that kind of thing. But yeah, it's really fascinating research that we can all take things away from.
Yeah, and but as soon as this podcast finishes, I'm shutting the door and I'm going to bugger off to Costa Rica. The big question really, though, is can you extrapolate the dietary factors when there are so many other lifestyle aspects? You know, the moving naturally, it sounds like a very low stress environment that people are in. Is it really possible to take away solid dietary advice from such an enormous wealth of different factors?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think that it's not just about anything in isolation. So the fact that they are living these lives where they have more family values, they spend more time, you know, with loved ones, they move more naturally, they sleep better, all of these things influence each other. So I think, you know, I haven't seen any specific studies on how we can look at the diet compared to the other things. But I think that when we look at it as a whole, we don't want to just think, OK, what's the most important factor and what can I do? We want to look at all of these factors.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of what I do as a dietitian. You know, I talk to people a lot about dietary intake, but I also regularly and in almost every single consultation ask people about how well they're sleeping, how is their stress, you know, how are they moving, because all of these things give the context to their diet and how they're living. So, you know, if you're spending more time with loved ones, you're maybe having your meals with family, you're putting more effort into cooking, you're cooking from scratch. I think all of these things really influence each other.
And to some extent, my question is a bit reductive, isn't it? Because what you're doing exactly is that you're helping people to change lifestyle. You're not just saying, here, you know, take some extra vitamin D. It's within a context of let's improve your life across the board. And so yeah, you're absolutely right. You can take away a whole series of different issues and communicate them.
Absolutely.
And I guess in a sense, you know, this is a food industry podcast, and so, you know, we're looking at people who provide food, but it is about providing more than that. It's about providing sort of a world around that and techniques and helping people to cook for themselves and all those other aspects. So I think you're absolutely spot on. Okay, now we've also heard a lot about just the concept of the Mediterranean diet. Do you think, again, that if you just talk about the Mediterranean diet, olive oil, you know, fresh tomatoes and things like that, again, you're sort of just missing the point a little bit?
I think when it comes to the Mediterranean diet, so the Mediterranean diet is the most studied diet out there. So when we look at it, we know that the beneficial impact comes from the focus on those whole fresh plant foods. And so maybe not perhaps the pasta or the red wine we associate with some of these regions, which we all enjoy as well. So when we think about the Mediterranean diet, we can think of it as a bit of a triangle with the point at the top. So at the bottom, making up most of our diet is the fresh, high fiber, whole plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, and lentils that we've talked about. The next section up contains our healthy fats like fish, nuts, and seeds. Above this again shows a pretty low intake of our poultry, eggs, and dairy. And at the very top, we've got a tiny amount of those meats and sweets, which are enjoyed sparingly. So we've really got plentiful diversity of those fresh whole foods. And it is this predominantly plant-based diet that means it's lower in energy, it's lower in saturated fats, it's higher in those phytochemicals we talked about, and produces important metabolites from our gut microbiota as well. So, you know, when we talk about fiber, it's not just helping our bowels move, it's actually having an active role in feeding our gut microbiome, which then produce substances called short-chain fatty acids, one of which is called butyrate, which has kind of anti-inflammatory, anti-tumour, those sorts of effects on our bodies. And the accumulating evidence indicates that there are five really important adaptations induced by the Mediterranean diet. So it's lipid-lowering effect, thinking about our blood fats, our cholesterol levels, protective against oxidative stress and inflammation that we know is so important in aging. modification of hormones and growth factors involved in the development of cancer, the inhibition of nutrient sensing pathways as well, and also, as I mentioned, the gut microbiota mediated production of metabolites influencing metabolic health. And several population-based prospective epidemiological studies have shown that adherence to the Mediterranean diet might have a protective effect in many different things like our cardiovascular disease, stroke, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, several types of cancers, allergic diseases as well, and more recently Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. A lot of this data is observational, so we do need to be careful of what we're assuming from those things. But there have been some randomized control trials. So one of these was the Lion Diet Heart study, which was actually stopped early due to the significant 70% reduction in all-cause mortality. And then there was another study called the PREDIMED study, which was a randomized control trial looking at Mediterranean diet supplemented with either virgin olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, or 30 grams of mixed nuts. And this group was found to have a 30%, I think it was, lower incidence of cardiovascular disease in comparison to those on a low-fat diet. So it has been well studied, and we do believe the effects are from that basis of whole fresh plant foods.
Yeah. So I mean, you've given us some amazing facts and some extraordinary statistics around these. On the whole, though, I would say that this is the kind of information that I've been trying to tell people for years, and I'm sure you have, and lots of people have, you know, we know the basics of it. It's amazing having the facts and the studies to prove it. But how the hell do you get people to change their lifestyle? So what I'm interested in is your patients. How do you go about this? Because we are stuck in our ways. We enjoy the foods that we know we enjoy. We're stuck in our lifestyles as much as our diets. I mean, what's the best way of going about it? Do you like scaring the crap out of your patients or sort of terrifying them so they go away and go, oh my God, I've got to change? How the hell do you do it?
Well, it's interesting because everyone is a bit different, but you're absolutely right. There are some real barriers out there to change. People are very, very used to what they're eating. They've been doing it for many years. They're very well used to those habits. And, you know, as we've talked about the food environment, our social activities, our, you know, who we're surrounded by, our work pattern, all of these things have a huge influence on what we eat. So when I approach it, no, I absolutely don't scare them. I tend to talk about, you know, the benefits. Talking positively about food, talking about what it can do is a really nice way to go about it. But then also coming back to that individual's lifestyle and looking at, okay, we don't need to be perfect tomorrow. We can actually start to work in the direction of what the science is telling us. So it's about breaking it down and thinking about, okay, within my lifestyle, what are the easy wins? What can I make a swap with? Where can I start? And I think a lot of people will think about, I think the approach to diet often out there is you're either on it or you're not. You're on a diet or you're not on a diet, or so that is a very sort of black and white approach to it.
Yes, yeah.
So the way that I take it is actually, you know, there's no deadline to be healthy by. You know, we want to continually progress and work on things, and we're not going to be perfect. You know, nobody's absolutely perfect with what they're eating. We all enjoy certain things. So it's about moving in the right direction, and it's about going more down the grey area. And when we think about behaviour change, you know, I talk about the behaviour change cycle with some of my patients. And actually, you know, a lot of people have the approach of if they have, you know, to use their terms, fallen off the wagon or something like that, then they'll often think, oh, you know, screw it. I'm not doing that anymore. I've failed. When actually,
Rosie told me this. I did it for a couple of weeks, but I've stuffed it now. So what's the point? Yeah.
Yeah. But we do know that the relapse is actually part of the behavior change cycle. So I don't really like the word relapse very much, but actually going back to original behaviors is part of that change. So there are going to be times where you go back and have the things that you had before, and that's absolutely fine. But it's about looking at the majority of your diet and how you can tweak it so you can make the most of things. So it's about that progression. And with my patients and clients, we set goals, you know, and we set little things that are realistic for them to achieve. And that then promotes kind of a positive mindset as well, and a positive approach to dietary change. Because if you think about, you know, success and failure, if you think I've failed, you set your targets too high, you think, oh, I failed, and you go into that negative mindset. If you set little goals, then actually you're setting yourself up to achieve them, to feel positive, and then to move on to the next one. And so that's what we kind of work around, is looking at individuals' lifestyles, what's the key priorities for them, and what can we start to work towards and start to build upon, so that moving forward, long term, we can change the diet. And that's one of the really important things about diet, is it's long term. It's not, you know, how we eat for the next 2 weeks is not going to affect our, you know, how we are in old age. It's what we do on a regular basis for the long term. So that's what I work with my patients and clients about, you know, working with that sort of long term aim of behavior change.
Yeah. And you've got to do things that are enjoyable as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, this is sort of a question that I can imagine any health professional would just go, oh, crying out loud. It always comes to this. What's the low-hanging fruit? What are the easy changes that you think you can communicate to your patients most easily? What's the first step?
I think when we're looking at diet specifically, it's thinking about how we can get more whole plant foods into the diet. That seems to be one of the kind of baseline things that we see across different dietary studies that can be really beneficial.
So what are you saying? Eat more beans.
Eat more beans. Yeah. If you don't like beans and you prefer your meat, then swap half and half, you know, put some red kidney beans in with your bolognese or some lentils in with it. Start there, or, you know, add a couple of extra fruits and vegetables. You know, we know that variety is really important as well. So adding some things onto the plate. And I think that can be beneficial because people think about what they're adding to the diet rather than what they're taking away as well. And that can be really beneficial for sort of your mind. And, you know, simple swaps to make things higher fiber. So swapping from white rice to brown rice, a really easy swap. Some people don't quite like the taste, and if people will struggle with that, we might go half and half to start with. Whole wheat pasta, swapping your white bread to wholemeal flour bread. Those sorts of things can be a really easy switch that can just start to work on the nutritional content of people's meals.
Yeah. Now, we've skipped over one issue that I'd like to drag you back to, and that is, could you talk a little bit more about cognitive ability and how that changes with age, and the potential for changing diets to help with that?
Absolutely. I think this is quite an important area, and you know, something that a lot of people are concerned about as we get older, is that loss of cognitive abilities. And in its position statement on diet and cognitive impairment and dementia, so SACN, which is the Scientific Advisory Committee for Nutrition, concluded that adherence to that Mediterranean dietary pattern, as we talked about, is associated with a reduced risk of mild cognitive impairment and dementias, including Alzheimer's disease. Again, that was sort of observational, so it doesn't really tell us any reverse causality there. So we do need a bit more research on that. But you may have heard of, there's some amazing work being done in this area. There's a husband and wife team called Dean and Aisha Sherzai, who've done a lot of work on brain health, and they believe that 90% of Alzheimer's can be prevented through a healthy lifestyle, which I don't say lightly.
Is there evidence to back this up?
Absolutely. So there is a more conservative estimate of 60% by the Alzheimer's Association, which is obviously still significant.
That's huge. It's absolutely enormous.
Huge. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't say that lightly. I have, you know, experienced Alzheimer's in with people close to me, and I understand how it's a scary disease. But I think that, you know, whether 90% or 60%, it shows, you know, the majority of how we live our life can have a big influence on it. So they focus a lot on nutrition, and they believe that actually diet can have a 50% effect. So in one paper, they described in 2019, four core drivers representing 90% of what determines disease progression in Alzheimer's. So glucose or energy dysregulation, lipid dysregulation, inflammation and oxidation, and lifestyle change can significantly alter these mechanisms. So I think there was one study when they looked at 3,000 patients with dementia in the region of Loma Linda, which is one of our blue zones. And they found that when they looked at 3,000 with dementia, they only found that 19 of those were on a plant-based diet, despite 50% of the population being plant-based. So that study just really highlights, you know, the potential lower level of these issues found in people having a predominantly plant-based diet. So,
and it goes back to the predominantly plant-based, less meat, the message that it's pretty pretty common.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's the same thing, but it has, I mean, that the impact of that on cognitive health, is that's spectacular, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of evidence around it, but I think that in terms of disseminating that information and that becoming more part of the support that people get is in its infancy. You know, it's not like some of the other diseases where one gene that's slightly off causes the disease. You know, there are some diseases where that occurs. But with Alzheimer's, it appears that you are more at risk with certain genes, but we can have a huge influence on those based on how we live our lives.
Yeah. Okay, so my last two questions for you really are about what can we do about this? So first of all, the medical profession. Do you feel that your voice is heard within the medical profession, you and your colleagues in nutrition? Is there enough focus on nutrition in medical school training? And is diet something that doctors now routinely talk about with their patients?
I think it really varies. So it's absolutely not routine by any stretch of the imagination. I think historically, you know, things like the NHS when it was set up and doctors training historically has been around, you know, very acute diseases that haven't been lifestyle influenced. These days, we have had a big shift in what diseases we're seeing as being most predominant, and those are now more chronic lifestyle diseases. So we've kind of overtaken the training with something different that is not embedded in that training. I think it will depend entirely on your doctor's own interests and research into diet. Some doctors are extremely well informed and will talk about diet as part of their work. Some won't have the knowledge, some won't have the interest, or some might even be quite misinformed. And there has been, as you said, historically some minimal training really in as part of a medical training course. Now these things are changing. So there are lots of great initiatives out there that are adding in more nutrition training into doctors' medical training. A lot of that is optional, but I think things are changing. But this is going to take time because new doctors with more interest in training in this area will filter through the training pathway and become kind of the next generation of consultants. But this will take time. And I think we can't rest on that either. A lot more work needs to be done. And you know, doctors don't need to be experts in nutrition and nurses don't need to be experts in nutrition, but they need to know kind of the basics on how to counsel patients and what the right foods are to choose. But they also need to know when it's appropriate to refer on to a registered dietitian or nutritionist. And we need more of them as well to support this. So actually recognising the diseases that can be influenced by diet and setting up some support with that. But, you know, with our overstretched workforce in the NHS, this is not something that we can just, you know, click a button and make happen.
Although the argument is so clear, isn't it? You know, if we can get people to eat better, then the entire NHS would benefit from fewer diseases in aging populations.
Yeah, concentrating on those that maybe aren't so lifestyle related, absolutely, yeah. And giving them better care, absolutely.
Which brings me to my last question, and this is probably the trickiest one. So this podcast is focused at the food industry. Food industry does not traditionally make money from selling cans of beans or certainly, you know, dried packs of beans. Do you think that the food industry has a lot to answer for pushing people down the wrong dietary path? Is there a lot that the food industry can do to help this and to help an aging population? But does that come into conflict with its one of its main reasons for existing, which is to make money? You know, as I say, you know, making a pizza and the more processed the food is, the more generally speaking, we're looking at profits for food companies. So that's a broad set of questions there. You know, how do you feel about the food industry and what could the food industry do to help?
I think that, yes, historically, the food industry has provided food that hasn't been beneficial for health and well-being at cheap, you know, costs and very, very...
You can be tough about this. You can be angry. If you're angry, you tell us.
They do have a lot to answer for in terms of those types of foods that they have been using. Whether, you know, that's probably not been intentional. You know, they have their own set of things that they want to achieve. They want to be able to, you know, profit. They need to find ingredients that work and that people enjoy. And, you know, they've tailored food so that they are kind of hyper palatable, something we would call hyper palatable, where we really just take such pleasure from eating them. So things that are high in both fat and sugar light up certain areas of our brain that show us that what we're eating is pleasurable, and doing that at a really cheap cost as well. So, you know, it's an obvious thing that, you know, if something's cheap, something's delicious, you're going to buy it and overbuy it. So I think it has been historically a very poor area, and I think that there is a lot that can be done, but I think it shows the opportunity for change as well within the food industry. So when we think about kind of convenience foods, they're not always a bad thing. So for elderly people or people who are less mobile, less able to stand and cook, less skilled, those sorts of things, convenience food is, you know, a good way to be able to get some nutrition. But we need to think about, there is an opportunity there to improve the nutritional profile of a lot of these convenience foods. So whether that's things like our ready meals or, you know, healthy snacks, I think looking at those things is going to be really important, because, you know, we can tell everyone to eat whole fresh plant foods. But when we think about coming to the practical levels of it, some people don't have the equipment, don't have the skill, don't have the ability, don't have the mobility, all those sorts of things. So if we can, you know, promote those things for people who can, but also improve the nutritional profile of a lot of the foods that we're eating that are more convenient, that's going to be the best way to sort of approach it. And I think when it comes to aging as well, you know, when we're thinking about things like, you know, supermarkets, we want to think about making sure that there's accessible parking for elderly people, maybe, you know, slow shopping times where people who are older can be able to, you know, get there and go a little bit slower around their shopping. So all these sorts of things can be really beneficial, I think. But also there's an opportunity, you know, when we think about the younger population and the people who are concerned about future aging, you know, there's an opportunity there to highlight things like fiber, things like phytochemicals, antioxidants, things that are going to be really important. You know, we've seen in the beauty industry that people want to invest in things that are going to improve their health and improve how they're going to be later in life, but also, you know, how they look as well. You know, skin health is a huge thing. So I think there's an opportunity there to promote the healthy parts of foods and how that can influence someone when they're aging as well. So although there's a historic, you know, difficulty with the food industry, I think they do, as you said, have a lot to answer for. There is opportunities there for improvement and for change.
And it should be said as well that there are also now quite a few quite healthy ready meals. You know, you can buy little salad pots and that are fantastic, that taste great. They've been well put together. Relatively recent, I think, that this has changed. And the key problem about them is they tend to be a bit more expensive, which sounds bonkers. They're using whole foods and they're using, you know, raw ingredients, which don't cost that much, but they're a bit more expensive. Maybe that will change.
Yeah, hopefully with sort of increasing demand, perhaps they would be something that would be more widely available. And, you know, I hope that moving forward we will get more options for convenience foods that do promote health and don't have huge amounts of sugar. And
yeah, and I think you can advertise these things to an older an older consumer, but as you've said, maybe that needs to happen earlier before the problems become embedded. Rosie, that you've been absolutely fantastic. What an enormous download of information that you've given us, and some extraordinary insights and some real surprises as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Rosie Martin. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslife.com. For example, you can go to the site and search for the edition called Keto Diet, Exploring the Science and Busting the Myths. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.